no people in the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Welcome, welcome to another Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Out to Coop Live is our call-in show. Yes, and it is Monday, February 8th, 2021. For those of you new to the show, for those who may be stopping by for the 17th time, you know, it's a reminder, Out to Coop Live is a place where we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts. Folks from right in our own backyard and from across the country. On Friday, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You can subscribe to all our podcasts on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We also stream our podcast live on our YouTube channel, which we're doing right this minute. So make sure you head on over there if you look for something to do and smash that subscribe button and hit the bell so that you know every single time we go live, you get that little notification and you can join in on YouTube. You can join in right here on Podbean. Only on Monday nights. Monday nights is our call-in show. So for those of you who are new to the Podbean format, you got to call in with your app, right? I'm telling this to our YouTube subscribers too as well. You can call in with your app on the app and, you know, take your calls, hear what's on your mind, and see what's going on. So you can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show on the Podbean app, you can show us some love right now, right during this show. You can just drop a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen. You can figure it out. Fill your digital pockets with Podbean's golden beans and then send us a gift of your choice. Every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast. And if you're looking for more PA-based progressive talk, don't you hesitate to tune into the Rick Smith Shows. Live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern, his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere you get the stuff. And you can also subscribe to his podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And I want a special shout out to Jonathan Mann. Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. That's SongADayMan, that's with two N's. SongADayMan on Twitter. He's got some great stuff. Man, he was tearing it up last week with the Jewish Space Laser song and with the... It was just incredible. It was fantastic. So, yeah. So he's great. Anyways, on today's show, I'm a little bit like recovering from snow and all this stuff. I don't know about where everybody's been sitting this week, but you know, after whatever 3 years or 2.5 years of barely getting any snow in Pennsylvania, at least southeast Pennsylvania where I'm at, we got hammered for the past couple weeks. It was absolutely beautiful. I absolutely love being out in it, but it's kind of threw my entire schedule off. But on tonight's show, in part, this was a decision I made in part because of the weather. Just didn't know what things were going to look like tonight. So I said, you know what, instead of trying to book a guest, and we had a couple people that were looking to come on, but then, you know, let's see if we can push that back a little bit before I kind of solidify plans for tonight and then watch it all go to hell if all the snow was coming. So tonight what I thought I would do is take a little bit of a dip, like, in the kind of yesteryear, so to speak. You know, here at Raging Chicken, we have been covering the Pennsylvania state system of higher education for 10 years now. If you want to put in, we had a, I was writing a blog before Raging Chicken that was called the ABSCUF KU Exchange, right? I called it the blogging on labor and higher ed, and it was like the an unofficial member initiated blog, right, of ABSCUF KU. ABSCUF is our union, our faculty union. That began, you know, back, you know, early, well, in 2011 too as well. So we're just about 10 years. Where, well, actually, that had done before that. But the part we're going to start with tonight is going to go back about 10 years. So anyways, you know, we've been exposing the lies told by university presidents and system chancellors, you know, for 10 years now. Was gone through, started with Judy Hampel, was the chancellor of the state system of higher education, and then came in, Kavanaugh. Not the Brett Kavanaugh dude, but another guy called Kavanaugh came in. And then, of course, we had the Jeb Bush dude from Florida, good old Frank Brogan. Like, you know, thank God that guy was as dumb as a doornail, because he really wanted to do some damage. He just didn't have the charisma. He didn't have the knowledge. He didn't have, you know, he thought he was a big shot and it wasn't a big shot, but whatever. But now we got this guy, right? I like to call him Chancellor McDreamy, right? Because he does very, very good hair, and he's a fairly good looking guy from the Silicon Valley area, you know, served as one of Bill Gates's, education czars from higher education for a while. He likes to be called by his first name, Dan Greenstein, Daniel Greenstein. So he came from Silicon Valley to Pennsylvania. So anyways, this coverage has been going on for a while. And we've shown at Raging Chicken, like, how these administrators, no matter who they are, have used deceptive accounting practices to pull the wool over the eyes of students, faculty, staff, and the public. We've given voice to faculty and staff and students and community members who fought back. And it seemed like it seemed timely to return to some of this stuff because of some of the attacks that are going on right now at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Now, we've talked a little bit about this. I talked to this when Brian Bailey was on the show. Hey, Brian, I see where Brian's in the audience tonight too as well. We talked a little bit about this on last Monday's Out to Coop Live, and we've been touching upon it on our regular Friday show too as well. But Indiana University of Pennsylvania, they were slated for something like 128 faculty losses. It's not quite as high as that right now, but when you add that with the faculty, with the staff and the program elimination, what's going on, it's pretty substantial. At the same time that this kind of, this wreckage that is being wrought at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, Chancellor Dan has decided that he wants to consolidate a bunch of universities, right? So he's taking these universities that are in kind of some of the rural districts, ones that are, just got to be said, some of the most underserved areas in our state in terms of higher education and access to higher education. He wants to kind of merge them all into one. Because it looks good on paper with his spreadsheets and all this stuff. I'm still determined. I'm under the belief that he wants to get a book out of this so that he can become a guru for higher education and what to do to state systems across the country. That's just my theory at this point. But he's looking to do innovative stuff, right? He's a disruptor. He's from Silicon Valley, right? So he's looking to combine universities. He's, been at the forefront of eliminating programs across the state. Indiana University's journalism program, right? They had produced multiple Pulitzer Prize winning journalists out of that program. They're eliminating the journalism program, right? I mean, it is pretty remarkable what's happening in Indiana University of Pennsylvania. But what the reason? Okay, so that's going on, and I have these two minds about what's happening right now. All right, the one side of my mind is just like on fire, right? And I get up in this vision that I have in my head of that side of my mind. I get up and I start yelling at the top of my lungs, "They're lying, they're lying, they're lying," right? So, but then I got this other side that is remembering I've been saying that for 10 years. And not just saying it, like, this is not just a hunch, right? I mean, part of the really difficult work that I did at Raging Chicken, especially for the first about 8 years, was like reporting on budgeting practices, about the ways that the administration and finance folks at different universities are utilizing the budgeting process as a way of deceiving the public. I've been talking about the ways that they have resorted to these like high finance Wall Street schemes that have left the education and general funds bankrupt at many universities, right? All the while they're crying crisis, right? For years I've been writing, thank God to, like, you know, one of my whatever prophets in the world, that's with a PH, prophet, and Naomi Klein, right? Naomi Klein came out with the Shock Doctrine, right? About disaster capitalism, around the time I was writing some of this stuff, and it was exactly what was happening. I mean, this was a human caused disaster that was happening to the state system of higher education. Brian was kind enough; he threw in a link to an article I wrote in Reflections Journal. Thank you, Brian, for throwing that. Yes, and that was back in 2010, right? So this is precedes Raging Chicken Press. And so what I've been thinking about doing a show like this for a while, and I've actually, if you've been listening to our regular podcast, if anybody's out there who listens to our regular podcast, I've been talking about this on our Friday show that I do with Sean Kitchen, about returning to the writing that I've been doing, that I've done over with Raging Chicken, and putting together some sort of book type thing. Whether it's, you know, I'm hesitant to say I want to go out and kind of search for academic publishers, because I just get tired of the time that it takes to get to do that. At the same time, there's nothing better than having a fantastic academic editor, like a publishing editor, to work with, about really kind of tightening it up. So I've been going back and forth with some different options, and be kind of something along the lines of a monograph that is going to be written to be used, right? Is basically saying we need to remember our history, because we seem to be in this space where it becomes really difficult to hold on to actually what's happening, or to admit that we're being lied to. And it's been extraordinarily frustrating to me, right? To the point where there's times, I'll tell you, and this, you know, this is true when I'm dealing with other faculty members, I sometimes feel like I'm banging my head against the wall, as people are looking around at me like I'm the crazy one, right? And I'm like, no, like, sticking your head in the sand and pretending everything's going to be all right is not going to make it all right. And matter of fact, we've got evidence, years of evidence, to show you the exact opposite of that feeling of, let me stick my head in the sand, right? So I pulled up some of these articles, and I just thought I'd kind of start a process. And I, you know, as I was realizing when I was prepping for tonight's show, I was realizing that, you know, the initial vision I had for tonight's show were really kind of going over the full 10 years. There's no way I could possibly do it during this time. So I've chosen some touchstones. And what I'm probably going to do is I'm going to read a little bit, talk a little bit, read a little bit, talk a little bit, and then, hopefully there'll be some folks out there that'd be like to jump into the conversation, because I really would like to get other people's kind of angles on things. Okay. But so let me just start the story. The story goes back, you know, like any story, right? You're picking an arbitrary place to begin. Right. And, the place that I'm going to choose to begin is on the eve of launching Raging Chicken Press. And, in the spring of 2011. Okay, this is on, if you remember what happened in 2010, there was the Tea Party victory in the midterm elections in 2010 that kind of, like, you know, took over Congress, took over state legislatures, and these kind of right-wing, kind of, like, you know, fanatical, well-funded, you know, billionaire, dark money, well-funded Tea Party Republicans took over and started immediately instituting these policies of gross austerity. And that was what we saw happen first in Wisconsin, right? We had the Wisconsin uprising, right? When Scott Wagner, the governor Scott Wagner of Wisconsin at that time, tried to strip away union rights, tried to take away, you know, like, the right to health care, break up their state system of higher education. It was a whole bunch of stuff. And then we started seeing the same thing happen in Ohio. If you listened to our live show last week, you know that Brian and I talked a little bit about this with the SB5 in Ohio, which is looking at this, do similar things. And then it was happening in Indiana and in Iowa, right? We saw that it happened in Idaho. We saw similar bills come out, and starting to realize that, wait, this is not a one-off. This is not Wisconsin. This is a playbook, right? This is a conservative playbook that's coming across the country. And I was, one of the things, that reason why I launched Raging Chicken to begin with had to do with that. recognizing it was coming, right? And my daughter, who, I'm sorry, Scott Walker. Thank you, Brian. That was Scott Walker, Wisconsin, not Scott Wagner. Scott Wagner's the, you know, our own little, you know, proto-fascist here in Pennsylvania that lost horribly in the last gubernatorial election. But anyways, but 2011 is also when we were due to have my daughter, who's actually sitting on the couch over there. And I knew that I had to do something, and returning to blogging publication was the way I thought we could do it. I had already been blogging for, like, as I said, with Abscuff KU here. And so when 2011, when then Governor Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania, he took over, and he was the, if you want to, the generous version of it was like he was the softer version of Scott Walker. The less generous version that Sean likes to Sean Kitchen likes to say is that he wasn't smart enough, right? He didn't have the skills to carry out what Scott Walker did. However you frame it, there was a proposal that he issued in February, I believe, of 2011. It called for a 50% cut in the budget for the state system of higher education. Now, for those of you who are not from Pennsylvania, state system of higher education is comprised of 14 state universities. So it started in like 1983. There used to be teachers' colleges, then it consolidated 1983 into a university system, became the state system. So it's 14 state universities that are part of that system. This is not Penn State, right? Penn State is what we call here in Pennsylvania a state-related school, right? They get some state money, but they are, for all practical purposes, they are a private institution. Same goes for Pitt, same goes for Lincoln, same goes for Temple. So the system that I teach, so I teach at Kutztown University, right? And that was part of this. And we just looked at this year, like 50% cut, like what the hell is going on, right? We had already been told by our university president at this point that, you know, look, we're going to have to kind of see some major cuts. We don't know what the deal is. We got to have some major cuts. Yes, it is true. Penn State. Yep. Penn State coaches. I'm sorry, getting a comment from Whatev 2070. Good to see you again. Penn State coaches are state employees. There's some weird how they're qualified or how the different positions in Penn State, they count. They're not like state system employees. They are state-related employees. I forget how they're categorized exactly. There's also true for some other folks there too as well. So there's a rally that's taking place in Harrisburg, right, in response to some of this stuff. And it was being held by the NAACP, and it was called the Children's March to Save PA Public Education. I was invited to be one of the folks that spoke. And so we were up on the Capitol steps, right? I'm sitting there waiting my turn to speak. I'm sitting there with one of my partners in crime at the time, Paul Quinn. We're getting ready to speak. And my union president at the time, a guy by the name of Steve Hicks, comes over to me and he said, "Hey, how you doing?" I'm like, "How do you think I'm doing? I'm mad." He's like, "You want to get really mad?" And he tells me about a meeting that he had just been to. And it's a meeting that he had been to with the Board of Governors, where the Board of Governors told everybody, all the university presidents, that they had to come to Harrisburg for an emergency meeting, and they had to bring their budget information. And they asked for specific budget information, right? Specific stuff that we weren't kind of quite privy to. So let me read a little bit from this article. This is from Before Raging Chicken. This is from, I titled it, "I Went to Harrisburg and My Head Exploded." Okay? So this past Tuesday, this is published on April 28th, 2011. "This past Tuesday, I joined a handful of Kutztown University faculty and students on a trip to Harrisburg for the NAACP's Children's March to Save PA Public Education. Nice thing about going to Harrisburg is that you tend to run into folks from ABSCUF, our state headquarters just a short walk from the Capitol building, and lots of other activists from around the state. Not only do you get to network with other activists, but you tend to learn things that you might not if you weren't to hear it for yourself. Shortly before I was scheduled to speak at the rally, I found out a bit of information about a recent Posse Board of Governors meeting that sent all sorts of veins popping out of my forehead. First, let me give you a little background before I drop the bomb. Over the past couple of years, our local ABSCUF KU leadership, particularly our meet and discuss team, has been probing Kutztown University's books and accounting practices. When this is then President Ceballos decided that he was going to retrench faculty this past year, we were given even greater access to the university's financial data as required by Article 29 of our union contract. For at least 2 years, we've been chipping away at a simple problem. How is it that Kutztown University has been in perpetual budget crisis when it had seen a nearly 20% increase in enrollment since 2002? It has seen class size explode and has the lowest faculty cost in the state system, right? So we're being told that we're in crisis, and yet, how is that possible? Every time we ask the provost and the administration and finance people this question, we're treated to rather vague explanations about increasing cost, but we have never been satisfied with that explanation. Then I talk a little bit about some of our faculty members. This guy, Ken Aronsall and Glenn Richardson, put together this proposal, this slideshow called Show Us the Money. And I'm going to include a bunch of links in the show notes of this eventually, so you'll be able to come back to the podcast and check it out. And it's called Show Us the Money, and it was demonstrating in figures exactly what I just said to you. How is it possible we have a declining number of faculty members overall, like percentage-wise, increase number of students, larger classes, that means fewer faculty teaching more students, and somehow we're in a huge budget hole. Made no sense. So fast forward to the NAACP rally. We have just opened the first major crack in that ruse, and let me cut to the chase. On April 6th, the Board of Governors meeting, Board of Governors budget meeting, an assistant vice president for finance presented a slide containing new budget projections based upon a 30% cut in PASHI funding and a 10% increase in tuition, right? This is basically their hopeful idea. Like 30% was like, okay, Corbett's calling for 50%. They're hoping they could get it down to 30. As part of that presentation, the assistant vice president of finance presented a slide listing all 14 PASHI universities. And this is the term that was used. It's called unrestricted net assets available. Unrestricted net assets. We had never seen that word before, right? But and the funds, so they showed that, and the funds needed to cover a budget gap caused by a 30% budget cut. So basically, you think about that, to call these folks there to say, look, how the heck are we going to even survive a 30% cut? We need you to come and show us the money so that we can figure out how we are going to be able to cover those costs, right? So the interesting number here is the unrestricted net assets available column, since it represents an actual funds the university has at its disposal to spend. These funds are defined by the Board of Governors policy on universal financial health. And basically, this is money that it represents all the funds in which the university can exercise discretion, and it may be used to meet the general financial requirements of the institution. So, for example, it's not money that comes from grants for a specific building. It's not money that comes from financial aid that's meant to get students. This is money that the university presidents, the university local administration, have the ability to basically use. So got that? That's what that refers to. Okay, so here we go. So given that KU just went through, Kutztown University, my university, just went through retrenchment and had declared a budget crisis for what every year I had been here since 2002, you would assume that KU would have very limited unrestricted net assets, right? Dead fracking wrong. As it turns out, and this is where my head exploded, Kutztown University has the second, and this is, again, 2011, has the second most unrestricted net assets in the entire state system. Do you want to take a stab at how much money the university administration has at its disposal to meet its general financial requirements? You want to take another guess? Not even close. Westchester University, which is like, it's always, this is the one, the most healthiest university in the state system. Westchester University tops the list with $36.1 million in unrestricted net assets. Kutztown University has $29.1 million in unrestricted net assets. $29 million. We had been told at that point that they were $6 million in the hole. And it turns out they were sitting there on a pile of money. And in that piece, you don't believe me? Here's the chart. So I'll show you the chart and show you what it is, right? Kutztown is second in the system after we had been told for years that they don't have any money, all right? So that's moment one, right? Moment one of the story is that was like, okay, here it is. And we went back, and I'll tell you, this is a little story of what happened at that point. We went back to our meet and discuss team, and I was actually, I was vice president of our faculty union at that point, our local, right? And we went back to our meet and discuss team, and through a bunch of other stories I won't get into, we were able to kind of pressure the university president and the vice president of administration and finance to come to the table, right? The budget stuff was on the agenda because they were going to cut all this stuff, but they were there primarily to speak to something else. We start to have this discussion, and then they answer the questions about the other stuff. They all say, oh, okay, we answered that. Now they're getting ready to go. We're like, okay, while you're here, boom, and lay this number on them. What is this? And we were told for the longest time that there were two piles of money, the state allocation, which they can use to cover cost, and the stuff that they can't touch, right? That comes from grants, that comes from, you know, special monies that are allocated for student stuff, all that kind of thing. You can't touch that. You can't move from money from one pile to the other. Because we had these questions like, why is it there's all these buildings going up? And where's that money coming from? How is it that you have a beautification plan? How is it you just spent $200,000 on new signage for the university, and yet you're telling us, you know, and those faculty that we had to rent like trailers to house because there was no room on campus anymore because it was so packed. How is it you have no money? And they're like, well, there's blah, blah, blah. And we get all this. But it turns out, no, there was a third pile of money. And when we presented that, the university president tried to say like, oh, well, you got to understand, Kevin, you got to understand the way this is, right? And I looked at this guy's name is Jerry Silberman. He was our vice president of administration of finance at the time. Look at him and say, is this right, Jerry? And he said, no, he's right. Me, I'm right. He's like, yeah, he's right. That's about right. He said, I wouldn't use the same words, but that's essentially true. And that was the first time that our university president flipped out and he said, that's right. I signed off on it and I would do it again. Right? He admitted to it. He admitted that he had been lying to us for years. Right? And so then we realized what was going on. Then we realized that they were creating an artificial crisis through accounting gimmicks, right? And let me put the story to you like this, right? So let's imagine that the university says, you know, hey, we think that students would love it if we had an outdoor like cafe that they could enjoy themselves on nice days. Right? They could come and sit around and we have some fresh coffee and we have some like, it's like, you know, premium roast there and some nice, you know, biscuits and cookies and baked goods for them. And they would love it. And we'll put it by the waterfall. And then, you know, the guys are tallying all this stuff up and they say, well, you know, Mr. President, I'm sorry, but that's going to cost about, you know, to really do it the way that you're talking about, it's going to cost about $2 million. Right. And so, instead of just throwing their hands up in the air and saying, oh, well, we have no money, what they do is they this. They said, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to take we're going to do it in 4 years. We're going to take $500,000. I'm making up these numbers, just so you know. You take $500,000 a year, and we're going to put it in this bank account, right? And we're going to label that account. It's going to say, like, you know, future project one, right? Because we know what that means. And it's going to put $500,000 in there. And it's going to show up on the balance sheets as a cost, right? So when you look at the balance sheet, you say, oh, they just spent $500,000. Turns out that's not accurate. They allocated $500,000 to a bank account. They still had the money, and that money was an unrestricted net asset. And so the following year, they put in another $500,000. The following year, another $500,000 until they get to their goal, right? Now, again, you understand, right? That's probably a good way to do stuff, right? Instead of taking out loans, right? Or doing that and going into debt, you put money aside. We could call that fiscal responsibility if you want to use that kind of jargon, right? And, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. But the thing was, if you're going to do that, you got to tell people what you're doing. You can't turn to faculty and students and say, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut 10% faculty jobs this year because we have no money. See? And then you can't turn to students and say, I'm sorry, we're going to have to raise your tuition by another 5% next year because, look, we have no money. See? And then you can't go to politicians, right, in front of the education board, right, in front of the, and say you need an increase in your funding Because you don't have any money, see? Right? All the while, when you go to the creditors, right? Because you want a good credit ratings. When you go to the creditors, you take out your other set of books, right? You take out that other set of books that they were able to show those people in Harrisburg, and you show them that you're sitting on piles of money. You say, see, we're financially sound. But the story you tell everybody else is that the reason why you're financially sound and you get a good credit rating is because you're cutting jobs, cutting programs, and forcing people to kind of have larger classrooms, forcing students to pay more and their parents to pay more. That's what they tell the public. That's what they tell politicians. But that's not what they are actually doing. They knew how much money they had then, and they know how much money they have now. There's a recent piece that just came out in the New York Times a couple weeks back, right, about what was happening at IUP. And in that story, it was an excellent story, right? Great story, covering what's happening in the journalism program, good interviews with some students in there, and does a really bang-up job in talking about some of the decisions that were made over several years, not just in Pashi schools, but in state systems across the country, is that they spent all this money using these financial schemes to build big buildings, luxury dorms, like, you know, special workout places. And they sank all that money in there, took on enormous amounts of debt, and paid that debt down through their educational general funds. Right? Now, that's something back in 2011 we did not know. Right? We had to dig this stuff out. And what's been incredibly frustrating, right, from where I sit, is that when you show people this, even when you're showing people who you think are your allies, right, and should be on your side and want to fight and expose this, they tell you to shut up, right? They tell you to shut up because if everybody knows about this, then there could be dire consequences for the state system, right? Fear drew, like, just was driving so many different players. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. Okay, so that's that piece one. The piece one is learning that the administration and finance people at my university were lying to me. And then we found out that they were lying at other campuses too as well. Right, so that was 2011. Now this is one of my favorite moments in all this, because I gotta tell you, I'm literally this random dude who's doing this research for this blog that I am supporting and I'm running, and not as my primary job. I'm doing this on the side because I know that there's something wrong. Okay? A couple years later, like 6 years later, maybe even 7 years later, I get a phone call at my work. Right? I get a phone call from a woman by the name of Colleen Bradley. Colleen Bradley was the former vice president of administration and finance at Westchester University. And she called me because I heard she got fired. I heard she got fired for exposing some kind of budgeting practices that were going on at Westchester. And she saw my article and she called me and she said, "Hey, I don't know if you remember my name. I'm Colleen Bradley. Down at Westchester, we have a lawsuit that's going forward, right, about a whistleblower lawsuit that is kind of going up to district court, or actually federal court, say which court, and has a potential to go to the Supreme Court. And I was wondering if you're interested in talking more." And over the course of several months, I sat down with Colleen. I have a mini documentary we put out with an interview with her and the lawyers that were representing her case. You can check it out at our website at RagingChickenPress.org. I'll put a link to it in this. It's in one of the articles in today's show notes too as well. And she basically went through and said, and you'll see this in the, you know, in the documentary. She goes through and corroborates everything that I'd been reporting on for the years before that. All right, that's 2018. She comes out and she tells her story. Not only did she tell me, right, but part of the reason she came to me is she got frustrated because our faculty union, ABSCUF, at one point was trying to make a case to the Board of Governors that there's something wrong in the budgeting. And Colleen Bradley came to ABSCUF, right, came to the faculty union and told them and testified for them, right, and basically said, look, this is what's going on, and showed, and you know, and she's got the receipts, right? She's got all the emails back and forth, and finds out that it wasn't just what was happening at Westchester, what she was being told to do at Westchester, but she had direct instructions from people in Pashi and the chancellor's office in Harrisburg telling her to cook the books. What's remarkable to me in all of this, the reason why you don't know Colleen Bradley's story and not why it's not a Hollywood movie right now, is because her case, through a technicality, did not go to the Supreme Court like it should have. Right? And it had to do with the fact nobody, never in her court cases, right, in her federal district court cases, right, in her Pennsylvania court cases, never in any of her courses has the evidence of what she's claiming ever been part of the trial. It's never gotten to that point. They basically said that since she was a state employee, she could not bring her suit forward. She never had her day in court. And when it came time to, quote unquote, friends to write an amicus brief for her, to write support for her, to get that case to the Supreme Court, to get it to the federal judges, nobody would do it. Because they're all afraid. So you've got this woman, one of the most courageous women I've met, right, who was really good at her job and saw that she was being asked to do something that was unethical, saw that on the out of the one side of people's faces, these administrators' faces, they were telling faculty and students and the public that the universities were broke, and the other side of their face, they were basically saying, we're in the money, we're in the money, and they knew it, right? And we'd publish this stuff, we'd send it out to the papers, we'd send it out to this, and it'd go nowhere. Meanwhile, we're getting hammered, right, on the state campuses. All right, so there's that. Fast forward a couple years. We find out that not only are there budget games that are being played, right, where they're keeping these two sets of books, we find out that there are some schemes that are going on that were even worse than we thought, that hid the money even more. All right, so bear with me on this one, and I might make this the last one I read anything from, because it's a little bit heady, and then we'll stop and we'll see if anybody wants to kind of jump in and got questions, calls, want to comment and things like this, right? So I wrote this piece. Now this is 2018 now, right? So this is, this is 2013. This is part of one of the pieces, one of the reasons why Colleen Bradley called me, okay? This piece I wrote called Wall Street on the Susquehanna. The Pashi bond scheme bleeds education budget for beautiful buildings. I get a little alliteration there, I guess. Alliteration happy. Okay, so here's the setup. This past July, so this was July 2013, 8 of the 14 Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education universities sent letters to their faculty and staff warning of the possibility of deep cuts, layoffs, and program elimination, what they like to call retrenchment. University presidents at California, Cheney, Clarion, Edinburgh, East Stroudsburg, Kutztown, Mansfield, and Slippery Rock all shouted, "Crisis!" and warned that unless they resorted to strict austerity measures, the end would indeed be near, right? So that was the setup, right? And in the article, I go in through some of the specifics of each of the university, right? I skipped out. The budget crisis, in quotes, at Pashi Universities has its roots in a long-term defunding of public higher education in Pennsylvania, Wall Street-esque risky investment schemes, and a virtual lack of oversight. So those three things, right? Long-term defunding of public higher education, and this comes from Democrats and Republicans alike, the slow bleed, removing funds from public higher education, right? Second one, Wall Street-esque risky investments, which is really at the core of this piece, and then a lack of oversight. Okay, so there had been all these defunding stuff, and we know that in Pennsylvania we saw a switch from back in 1983-84 when the system was first founded. About 64%, upwards of 64% of the cost of higher education, the tuition and fees, was paid for by the state. right, from state appropriations, and about 36%, right, of the costs were paid by parents and their family. When you fast forward to today, you're about 25%. This might even be lower now, but 25% of the funding comes from state appropriations, and upwards of 75%, close to 75% of the costs are borne by students and their parents. And then you wonder why Pennsylvania has one of the highest rates of student debt in the country. Well, there you have it. Okay. So Pennsylvania was not alone. This was all going on. So in one of these sections, I say of bonds and balance sheets, and this is the other part I want to read from you. Until the year 2000, PASHI had a fairly centralized process for initiating new building projects on any of its 14 universities, and the official guidelines were pretty murky. One of the Board of Governors policies that addresses planning for new buildings, and I give the number of it, it's called Facility Projects Contract Compliance Program, had more to do with ensuring compliance with Act 188, which is, and their non-discrimination policy that was the founding act for the state system and Pennsylvania legislation. But with respect to awarding of state contracts, than it did with laying out a process for making decisions about where to build and why. So it was basically saying, okay, look, if you're gonna have a contract, you're gonna build a building on your campus, you basically are subject to the same non-discrimination laws that anybody else who was a state contractor would have to do. Right? That's kind of what it is. And they said, you know, we'll go through here. There's not a single mention about how the chancellor, or the board of governors, or anyone else. This is the original policy. Decides when new buildings had to be built. The only thing the policy has established is a centralized process of communication. Everything goes through the chancellor's office. Now, this policy is replaced on July 13th, 2000, with this other board policy called Capital Facilities Planning, Programming, and Funding, right? And the board policy does three things, right? It changed it and makes it much more explicit, but does three things. One, it decentralized new building planning. So the new board policy required each university to establish a facilities master plan that will help determine the need to, for any new building projects according to the policy. Only those projects that satisfy, this is quoting from the policy, that satisfied a valid space deficiency, a system or Commonwealth educational requirement, or renew an existing facility for a valid mission requirement will be submitted to the board for approval. So instead of it being all happening at the chancellor's office, they would have each university would do this and pitch it, right, to the board. The second innovation here. It was privatized funding for new buildings and capital projects incrementally. So as part of this expanded role of the board, in turn, quote, require universities to contribute funding from alternate sources for some projects. Project receiving significant private support will receive higher priority recommendation for public funding. Public-private alliances or public or private sector support for academic facilities that satisfy system educational requirements and or contribute to global competitiveness and workforce needs are strongly encouraged. Now, PASHI's webpage at the time stated that the system's desire for turning new capital projects, especially student housing, over to the private sector was even more direct. This is, again, a quote from the policy. The PASHI Board of Governors policy is that new student housing be satisfied through private development to the extent feasible. Development is generally by a viable supporting 501c3 tax-exempt affiliated organization. Development may be either off-campus or on-campus with lease of the site to the tax-exempt affiliated organization. And if you dig deeper, they say this. You can even see that spelled it out. The alternative funds, board probably has about 50%, they require 50% of the project to be raised by all new, 50% of the project cost to be raised for all new academic facility space, right? So they wanted 50% had to be raised from funds. Typical source of alternative funds includes gifts, unrestricted endowment income, corporate sponsorships, camps, conference, and similar net incomes, federal funds, university operating funds planned for capital improvements, or cost avoided with documented significant improvements in instructional or operational efficiency and effectiveness. What that means right there in that new policy, cost avoided with documented significant improvements in instructional or operation efficiency and effectiveness, that means getting rid of faculty members, increasing class sizes, shifting things to online instruction and employing a higher percentage of adjunct faculty members. That's what that means. When they say costs avoided with documented significant, that's what they're talking about. They incentivized in the board policy austerity measures. right? And then it says, with formal Council of Trustees of Board approval, Pashi bond funds, here's the other part, bond funds may be used to meet the case flow requirements of the project versus receipt of revenue. Revenue from sources such as those listed above should fully cover all bond expenses, including fees, debt service, and principal. You got that? So number one, they said, you do it locally. Number two, they said, we want you to look for funds. And look, these are teacher colleges. This is not like Ivy League schools that have endowments that go off the charts, right? These are state system schools designed, right, to serve the working class of Pennsylvania that do not have the traditional access to higher education that you would if mommy and daddy are kind of like, you know, raise you with a silver spoon in your mouth. These were leveler institutions meant to kind of give access and make education affordable and available to everybody. And instead what they say, what we're going to do, so, you know, my point being, you're not going to be going to like Bill Gates and saying, hey, Bill Gates, why don't you kind of send us like $85 million for our funds, like Harvard? They're going to be like, okay, you teach, yeah, your faculty don't do near the kind of research they do at Harvard because they're teaching four classes with large classes. No, sorry, next. Right? We are a teaching mission university, right? Not the kind of universities that take in tons and tons of cash and revenue. But, you know, again, I understand you want to push them to get out there. But the main piece in that, which nobody talked about, was that it was an incentivized in that board policy from 2000. And you know who it was pushed by? Freaking Ed Rendell. The former governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell. The union-busting Ed Rendell. The main Democratic operator in the state of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell, pushed for this crap. Okay? Last piece to this. They wanted to finance new building from university. Oh, I should mention one thing. One other key part about that, about the bonds. Like, notice what it said about the bonds. The individual universities do not take out the bonds. The state system is going to take out the bonds. They're going to underwrite it, but the university has to submit it forward, right? Okay. The third part is finance new buildings from university education and general funds. So in other words, that money in the unrestricted net assets, which is about improving the educational quality and access for students, now they're saying you can raid that too. So the incremental shift towards privatizing aspects of Pashi or to enter into the public-private partnerships, to use former Governor Ed Rendell's favorite term, shows that gradual defunding of Pashi, as shown in the chart that I have in here, not only represented a dramatic shift in cost onto students and their family, it also represented a shift in the core character of Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities. In short, Republicans and Democrats in Harrisburg allowed and advocated for the marketization of public higher education in the Commonwealth. However, the shift in Board of Governors policy regarding the financing a capital project also documents a shift in how debt was issued for these projects and how the debt would be repaid. Beginning with the 1996 policy under Governor Ridge, so this predates even our pal, what do you call it, Rendell, right? Under Governor Ridge, individual universities would begin financing new building projects with bonds, and those bonds would be paid back through a combination of alternative funds, remember where those come from, and directly from a university's educational general funds budget. They gave them permission to pull it from the educational general funds thing. Fundraising had always been a challenge at Pashi schools, which I already talked about, right? So this was going to happen. The shift in policy amounted to a huge gamble. The gamble was based on unsubstantiated hope that Pashi University would be able to turn itself into a hub for private fundraising and that nothing significant would change when it came to Pashi state appropriations. Now, why am I telling you all this, right? Why am I asking you to go into the weeds with me to look at this nonsense, right? And I'm asking you to do this for this simple reason. This is where it happened, right? This is where the deception began, and this is how they made it happen. So a few things to notice. They said, look, hey, you want new dorms? That should happen through a 501c3, right? A nonprofit organization. Who are those nonprofits? Well, at Kutztown University, it happened to be the Kutztown University Foundation, which is supposed to be separate and distinct from the university. Instead, they were in cahoots. They planned together. At East Stroudsburg, they set up another nonprofit. Like, they set up a nonprofit strictly in order to accomplish these things, to build these new buildings. right? And then the trick was, is they had little lines on their budget, right? The Kutztown's case, the Kutztown University Foundation, they built these freaking luxury dorms, these suites, like hundreds of them. And the foundation, technically, the foundation built those, right? They took out those loans. They're the ones who were responsible for that, right? But there's one problem with that, right? They kind of took out those loans, but not really. They just did it in name, knowing that the university was going to give them the money. So Kutztown University, it turns out, we find out years later, and I'll tell you how we know that in a second, years later, that Kutztown University had been just every year funneling $500,000. Here you go. To the foundation. But it wouldn't appear on the regular books as an expense. It's just gone. Right? And then the foundation would take that money to pay down the debt. Right? It was crazy. Especially when things didn't plan out the way that they wanted it. So here's it. So for example, 2002 now, right? Kutztown University was searching for a new president, and the job description for that position made several mentions of the need to raise external funds for development and growth and compete and complete multiple capital campaigns, right? Now, here was the trick. So President Ceballos back then basically came in and basically said, it clearly states this new president is going to be complete an $18 million capital campaign and planning the next major campaign. That Third Century Fund, as it was called, referenced in the job description that began in 1999, but the director of university relations, Matt Santos, said the actual amount for the Third Century Fund was $15,250,000, not $18 million. When it was completed in 2003, according to Santos, the Kutztown University Foundation actually raised $13,768,884 toward that goal. Nearly $3 million of that capital campaign was designated for the new BAM Science Building, right? Now, on the books, what they were telling people, right, those bonds were based upon the projections of the amount raised, but they don't raise that money. So what happens? They didn't meet their goal. So what happens? That means they have to take more money from the Education and General Fund, use austerity to fire your faculty, eliminate programs so that they can funnel that money over to pay down their debt. All under the cover of darkness. Nobody knew what was going on except those folks on the inside. Right? And look, this was happening at the same time. It turns out that this is a... there's this thing, right? It's called this policy. If I can just find it real quick. I'm sorry. This thing is called the Enron Corporation, if you remember this. For those of you who've been around for a while, right? The Enron Corporation was an American energies and commodities services company, and they basically famously went bankrupt in 2001. People went to jail, all this other kind of stuff. And they went to jail for this kind of like accounting fraud. Okay. And they use this thing, right? This particular tactic that was called an off-balance sheet debt financing or financing schemes. And these were super popular in the U.S. colleges and universities because it did two things. It allowed you basically to you start this nonprofit, and this is why they made those changes in that budget policy and that policy. You start your nonprofit, the nonprofit takes on the debt officially. Right. The university doesn't have that debt. It gets its new dorms, doesn't have its debt. So when it goes to creditors, right, when it goes to them and says, hey, look at our sheet, it shows a great financial health. When really what's going on is that all the debt is being accumulated in a nonprofit organization. Or like Steve says here, you had the Student Services Incorporated division of the university at Shippensburg was the place where the debt was accumulated. Right. Now, the other thing that goes on here is that those bonds, right, university presidents, they're not going to feel the sting from this, right? Because those bonds are actually being held in Harrisburg, at Posse in Harrisburg. They're not being held by the university. So now you have 14, not all 14 universities did this, but several of these 14 universities did this. East Stroudsburg, Westchester, Kutztown, Bloomsburg did some of this. Shippensburg did some of this. You had, of course, CalU, right? California, again, people got prosecuted for it there. I mean, it's like crazy, right? So this also, you have all these individual universities submitting the individual plans because they want their university to compete in the marketplace of college, like, you know, admissions by having pretty luxury dorms and suites and great workout places and beautified campuses. They want that because that's going to serve them when they decide to hop out of there and go to their next job, right? It's going to serve them. But meanwhile, Pashi and Harrisburg is basically on the hook for all the debt being accumulated by these nonprofit organizations, right? It's crazy. So let me cut to the chase, I guess. Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's exactly like Trump's bookkeeping practices. The thing is that this was going on everywhere in Wall Street. Ed Rendell, the reason why Ed Rendell got in is because he was a big Wall Street guy, still is, right? Loves Wall Street. And was using Wall Street tactics because there was this big boom on Wall Street saying, you know what? We can just let Wall Street keep on rising, right? And we're going to basically accumulate interest on the investments that we make. And then we're going to pay out. It's basically a Ponzi scheme, right? And so we don't have to worry about it. And so what a lot, and there's excellent reporting on this. If you go and you check out the, you know, some of the articles that I have posted here, there's excellent reporting on this, which tracked this precisely at a point where public college universities were starting to hit like a crisis of funding levels in the 90s, right? And they were looking for, you know, some way to kind of deal with the increasing need because their students were flooding to college, right? Everyone, from the time they were like elementary school on the way up, they were being told, you got to go to college, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. If you're going to be anybody, you got to go to college. So suddenly there's all this expansion of college they want access to. And they're all working class students, right? Who are first generation students in many ways, in most cases. And they're wanting access to these institutions. But Republicans have, since the Reagan administration in the 1980s, have begun cutting funds to all public services. So these universities were saying, how do we find more money? We need more money. Where do we go for it? And what they did is they followed Wall Street. They made bets on the projection of the future by using these bond schemes, right? And eventually the bills came due. So you got these two things going on, right? And like, I've got other stuff tagged here, but there's no way that I can ask you to sit and listen to more of this, any more than this at this point. This is a good chunk to bite off. So they lied. We caught them in the lie. They were lying to the public. And, you know, and not only did they have these bond schemes with a debt, the worst part about it is that they were still making money. They were still being able to pocket tons of money and keep it all on the backs of students, family, faculty, staff members. We all took the brunt of it. So that those administrators and those chancellors could shine to the world. It's disgusting. And so I'll tell you, I'll close with two things, right? I'm not going to read anymore now. I'll close with two things and see if you have anything else to say. I mean, I could talk all night, believe me, but I'd love to hear what you'll have to, what anybody out there who has to say. I'd love to take your comments and your questions. So I'm just going to make myself more mad, though. I know I'm going to be. I'm going to do it anyways. So I don't know why this is not coming down. Sorry, I got distracted. Okay. So I remember I approached, this is years ago, I approached some folks in our union leadership about this problem. I'm not going to just like tell you all the nitty gritty details on it because that's not my point here tonight. And I said, look, we need to do something about this. And it was especially around when Colleen Bradley was talking to me. And, you know, I have all the documents, right? And I said, look, we need to support her, right? We need to support her. And I was told, no, we can't. We're not going to go out on a limb for this. We're not going to expose what Pashi did. Right. And I'm like, why the hell would you not want to show the world why their kids are being asked to pay more money, why, when they've been lying to everybody, is that, and what I was told was that because Republican lawmakers in the state of Pennsylvania, if they hear they had been lied to, that the universities actually have more money than they're claiming, then they are going to gut the state system. And then we're going to lose our jobs and all this other kinds of stuff. And I'm just sitting there like, are you freaking kidding me? Are you freaking kidding me? That assumes we have no agency in this process. That assumes that we're just going to let them do whatever they want. Why don't we take the initiative here and make our case? Why don't we go directly to, we should be having press conferences about this. And then I was told, we as a union have to worry about more than just one campus. We have to think about everybody, and it could negatively impact other campuses. And I'm like, are you kidding me? While that's happening at Harrisburg, while you all at the state level are kind of like jockeying around and trying to kind of like come to some sort of backroom deal by not exposing these people, we're paying for it on the campuses. Faculty are losing their jobs. Our work is becoming untenable. The clerical staff are losing people left and right. The grounds crew has lost like the bulk of their people. We're getting slaughtered. And students are being asked to take on more. And parents are being asked to take on more. We're all being lied to because of the university presidents, and the administration is lying. How dare they? We need to take it back for the public. That should have been the argument. I was told to go away, which I didn't for a couple years. And then I had it, whatever. So that happens. And then right now, when IUP, we have a new university, our new faculty union president now. Her name is Jamie Martin, and she's from IUP. She's a criminologist, right? I think that's the right title for her. But she's the president of our union now, and she was the vice president for a while. But she did what I haven't seen any of our union presidents do before. And it was still, I tend to go whatever with the torch and pitchfork. She was much more diplomatic than I was. But she basically laid out this argument to the board, among other things about the claims about demographics and other kind of stuff, where, if we're told that we're suffering, you read any like newspapers that what's happened over the past 10 years or 5 years that Pashi schools, oh no, demographics have changed. And now there's all the students that are leaving. There's no students anymore. And now we're hitting this crunch. It's actually, if you expand the timeline out beyond 8 years, you go 20 years. It turns out that we're actually on a pretty straight line of increase. We had a bump in the middle, which everybody predicted, everybody knew was coming. We had a bump in the middle, and then it went back down. But the graph, if you draw it, is like a steady line up. So there's a manipulation of data from our kind of like our Chancellor McDreamy now, our kind of our Silicon Valley Chancellor, Dan Greenstein. He is using that 10-year figure and shopping around the PR stuff to show that we're in crisis, to accomplish whatever end it is. Maybe some book deal, movie deals. He'll get to be fulfill his hero complex. I don't know what it is. But, and all in the midst of all this, right? I mean, Jamie was the first one to go to the Board of Governors and begin to say, this, we have to have some accounting here. Because one of the other pieces that I wrote about, which again, I'm not going to go and read anymore right now, was that how every time they identify a problem, right, there's only one solution, right? If it's like, oh my God, state funding is cut, what's the solution? Oh, cut faculty and staff and raise tuition. Oh my God, there was a financial scheme that was kind of manipulating stuff. What do you do? Like, do you throw people in jail? Do you have public hearings? Do you kind of like ask them? No. You cut faculty and staff and raise tuition for students. The solution's always the same. There's no accountability for those people and what they did to our state system of higher education. There's no accountability for them. It's the same damn story everywhere. The people at the top get away scot-free. They wreck it for the rest of us, and then we have to pay the price for it. It's disgusting. So this is the first of my little reading moments on Pashi. And like I said, you're going to have I've got somebody working with me a little bit on this to kind of help me compile some of this stuff and put this together. And that's going to be one of the projects that's actually took me out of kind of a hole, to be honest with you. Right. Because I didn't know what to do. It seems like there's at a time in history when we see mass movements in our streets, that we see unprecedented kind of progressive advancement and really smart organizing at the local level, because of militant labor actions taking place kind of across the country, right? People with everything to lose stepping up and fighting back for people who they think have more to lose than them. I mean, this is amazing. And yet those of us, whether we sit in these kind of positions of this kind of middling power, right, where we have something, right? I'm a unionized faculty member. And too often it's the case that what people will do, instead of joining with others to beat back this structure, they're just going to try to keep what's theirs, and that's all. And that is where it takes our one leadership from below in our unions and our organizations, or leadership from above. I don't care where it comes from. But preferably leadership from below that is going to demand a different course. Then it's going to demand that we can do more than just take what's ours. All right, I got a call in. Brian's calling in right now. Love to hear from him. Hey, Brian, what's going on?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you now, man.
Hey, I got a question for you. So what happens to, I think these are chancellors. So you're saying Chancellor McDreamy is the current chancellor, correct?
Yeah, Dan Greenstein, yep.
Okay, so good old Dan there. Like, what happened to his predecessors? What sorts of, like, what other jobs? Did they move on to new jobs? Did they go to Wall Street? Did they go to another university?
Well, Frank Brogan, the one who came right before him, went to work for the Trump administration in the Department of Education under Betsy DeVos. So he failed upward. Kavanaugh, before him, he went on to be I think he was a chancellor of another state system university someplace else. And then Linda Rinker, before him, she went on to become, I think she ended up as a president of a university after moving around a couple of places. So they ended, they were all fine.
So basically what it sounds like, when you were saying earlier that these chancellors they've benefited from the building booms because it's something tangible they can point to?
I think
you're saying
yes. But I think it was more so, like, I think the incentive structure for having beautiful buildings, for example, was more on university presidents than it was on the chancellor's office. What the chancellor's office did is they set the terms, right? And they said, we need these things as a system. But if you're looking for, who are the little climbers, right? Who are the ones that really, really wanted to climb? And they have been the university presidents. Right, they're the ones who have been like full-scale rebranding, full-scale PR campaigns, and then will go out and shop that PR campaign as they go on and go on to other universities. Now, what Chancellor McDreamy, Dan Greenstein, he's cut from a different cloth, right? I mean, in a sense, he is super savvy, super smart, and I think he has a bigger game in plan. I what that end game is, I'm not sure. Does he want to be kind of head of the Department of Education down the road? Does he want to run for a higher office? I don't know about that. Does he want to start his own consulting firm? I'm not so sure. But I think I would be surprised if a book project doesn't come out of this, which is laying out the pathway for the future. The guy's going to get rich one way or another off of this. It's just a question of where he ends up. And he came, and the one thing I will give him credit for is that he didn't hide the ball. He came in and basically said, I chose to come to Pennsylvania because it's the most opportunity for kind of radical transformation, right? I mean, so, but the thing is, he's got, and I think you and I may have talked about this at one point before, but, he came in and basically he's got all the markings of the cultural liberal, right? He's very accepting, wants diversity, he's got good taste and he's cultured, all those kind of things. So he was able to kind of, woo people a bit and make everybody believe in his win-win scenario, right? His Silicon Valley speak for the state system. And it's just not true. It's the same playbook, except he's more skilled at it, and he's done it before, right? And he got his training in the Bill Gates, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation. Hmm. If that makes sense.
No, it does. And then I have another question. Does Pashi, are they doing any of this also through their sports programs? In like moving money around?
I don't know if
Pashi has any sports programs.
No, not as much. So like what you all have out in Ohio, we have a different, what University of Cincinnati is doing with other kind of like what Miami University, where I got my PhD, where those programs are really invested in their sports program, really invested in Division I. We're all Division II, I believe. There's some of the smaller sports that are Division I, but they're not getting any funding. So you don't see that same structure that's going into sports there. Really, it's about the building and the infrastructure and the beautification, which is where the vast majority of the money is at. They basically have believed, they've convinced themselves, right, that the only way that they have to compete is through the amenities that are available. And they have to compete with the privates. That's what they have in their mind. And so that's what they're doing.
So is the stated plan, last question, I'm sorry, I'm taking up a bunch of time, but is the stated plan essentially to change the demographic of the students that go to Pashi? Because that's kind of what it sounds like they're doing, is they're saying, we're shooting for a new demographic, so we have to have these more upscale services now.
In part, yes. They're basically saying that everything is a financial scheme at this point. Like, so for example, at Kutztown University, what they talk about students as revenue centers, right? You know, like literally at one point we had negotiators refer to students as cash cows, like at a negotiating table. Right.
Pleasant.
And yes, it was. And students dressed up in cow costumes and all that. So that made for great kind of resistance. But that was fun.
Right, right, right.
But so what they did, for example, what also has come out is that basically you need a better mix of students. And we're like, what do you mean by mix? You need the diversity, right? That's what we're talking about. And they're like, no. You need more out of state students because they pay higher tuition costs. Right. So any student and like at Kutztown University, they expanded their international programs, right? Because they pay full tuition. And so they were seen as again, cash cows, right? They were and so were out of state students. Now they've always maintained that they are trying to, you know, they're servicing and Greenstein has been clear about this, servicing working class students, right? But the kind of the discourse about serving working class students doesn't match the practices, right? And what you have seen is at Kutztown University, for example, you see a steady increase in the kind of the class position of incoming students. So it is not a stated effect, right? But it is nonetheless the default effect, because those students who are now priced out of state system higher education tuition, right, are no longer applying here anymore. Right. I see Steve has joined in too as well. Steve, you want to, what do you got, man? Steve, are you there? Steve has called in, but I am not hearing you, Steve. Unfortunately, you got your mic, Steve? I'll tell you what, Steve, I'm going to disconnect you. If you get that fixed with your mic, call back in. I'd love to hear from you. So, yeah, I mean, this is exactly the kind of scenario that we've got. And, you know, again, like literally people are getting priced out of public higher education. And it's sad. You know, I've told this story. I've probably, you know, if you've been listening to the podcast at all, I've probably told this story at some point. I used to live in Washington, D.C., right? So I was there for 3 years, kind of working on my PhD. And then, you know, at the time when the global justice movement kind of exploded, it was just an amazing moment to be there. But I love living in D.C., right? You know, people's images of what D.C. is from the outside is very different than kind of living there if you're spending time in like communities and stuff. right? I just think the town is beautiful, right? Once you get into all the insider politics crap, that's just horrible. But like, just, I worked at a bookstore there for a while, and it was just the conversation I have with people that I worked with, which is great, right? I mean, just like good people. There's, you know, ride your bike through parks, all stuff. I just love, there's so much about DC I loved when I was there, right? Even if I just would, my stomach would turn some of the politics. Yeah, try again, Steve. Here we go. Steve's trying to call back in. Let's see. Steve, can you hear me? Steve, do you got a headset on by any chance? So I'm not hearing you. You do. It's not muted? I don't know why you're not coming through. All right, you'll type it in. Okay, that's fine. So I love DC, right? And when I finished my dissertation, I had been adjuncting first at George Washington University and then at George Mason University. I applied to a bunch of universities, a bunch of schools, a bunch of jobs, whatever jobs were on the books. And I was lucky enough to I landed an internship one summer at the American Federation of Teachers. It was kind of odd to be there as an intern. It was a paid intern, it's a union, you get paid for your internship. But I was, because I was older, right? A lot of time interns were younger. But I got a position in the higher education division doing some research on kind of part-time faculty contracts, adjunct faculty contracts, right? And what provisions were in there. Anyways. And so as part of that research and some of the people I would call to, I became familiar with the ABSCUF contract, with the union ABSCUF, which I'm part of now. And so when I was applying for jobs, I had never heard of Kutztown University before. I'm not from Pennsylvania. I'm from New York. I had never heard of Kutztown University. I didn't know about Westchester University. I didn't know any of these things. But when I read them and I looked them up, I saw that they, and I knew from once I got to their pages and saw where, these were universities that were part of ABSCUF. So I knew that I was going, yeah, exactly. I knew that I was going to be part of a union if I went to Kutztown. So I was like, I am definitely mentioning going to, I'm definitely going to apply to Kutztown. Definitely going to apply to Westchester. I didn't get the job at Westchester. Seth Kahn got my job at the same time. So I just wish, man, I wish they opened up two positions. I would have, if he and I got hired at the same place, it would have been like the dream of my life, but whatever. But then I probably never would have met my wife. I wouldn't have my beautiful kids. So whatever. It's all good. Anyways. So I came to Kutztown, and I got, in the end, after I was done my job stuff, it came down to two jobs that I was considering. And one was Kutztown, and the other one was George Washington. George Washington offered me a position. It would have been more money. I would have been teaching about half as many classes. And I had tons of friends that were there that I taught with before that I absolutely loved and was still working with. And what it came down to is I chose to come to Kutztown because there was a union. And it was working with kids that reminded me of kids I grew up with. I shouldn't say kids. Young adults that like from my neighborhood. And that's what I wanted. And I had been an adjunct at George Washington and helped kind of organize and was an organizer for the union there to try to get kind of adjuncts a union, right? So I also knew what it meant not to have protection in higher education. So I wanted a union position too. And so that's where I ended up. And it's been really hard. Let me just put it that way. To see what these people have done to the states of higher education with no accountability. I feel it in my bones. And like, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but last year, this is even before the pandemic, probably even goes back a couple of years now, as I was so burned out. Like, and I've told some friends, and now I'm telling like, well, the world now, whatever. But that's the first time I ever felt beaten. Like, I felt Kutztown beat me. They won. I don't see what else. I feel like my career has been wrecked, right? Not because they came after me. If they come after me, that's fine. I'll go toe to toe with anybody. It's not a problem. I'll sue the crap. I don't care, right? That's not what I mean. I mean, they took, this is going to sound schmaltzy, but whatever. They took the magic and the hope and the joy out of my job. All I ever wanted was to contribute to this and to kind of build amazing programs that were going to help students. And they just tore it apart, like brick by brick, until I felt defeated. I was burned out. Nobody should ever have to go through that. Especially, look, it's one thing if you got something with COVID, right? I tell people all the time, nothing you can do about this. This you really can't do. You can put your freaking mask on, you can stay home, and you can suck it up. And this is hard stuff, right? But we really don't have a choice here, right? We really got to, this is what we got to do, right? To get rid of this virus, right? That is completely different from what they did to the state system of higher education. That was a choice. They systematically are in the act of destroying it. I want to get to Steve's question. Steve typed this. He said, thanks. He said, you mentioned faculty wanting to keep their head in the sand. What can we do to activate members so they see themselves as a union? In other words, rank and file activism. Steve, look, my hope right now has to do with the organizing that is happening around our unions. Like, I believe that that our hope right now is in working with student activist groups and community-based activist groups to basically learn from our K through 12 brothers and sisters, is that we're building organizations for the long haul at this point. Right. And yes, I mean, I was talking to some people not too long ago about this, you know, who came in with, you know, around, you know, Steve came in about came into ABSCUF the same time I did, around the same time I did. I came in 2002, and we had it felt like a new generation of people that got together and started organizing on our own. And then we got elected. I mean, it's the same freaking story you see happening in our city councils and everything right now. Hey, Sean. You got elected and you built the power from the ground up, and then you exercise that power. It just seems that, you know, we've lost that a little bit. And some of it, look, frankly, you know, there's a long time I put that on my own shoulders, right? And other people that I organize with. But, you know, at some point, you need a break. Right. It's not just about individuals. It's about building structures and stuff. It's about building this. And I think that, you know, we had in our faculty union, we had fits and starts of this stuff. We had like an Eastern Caucus we started at one point. We wanted to have this caucus system throughout the state so we can meet outside of like official bodies and begin to strategize and think about what we want. Right. Within our own faculty union, our local faculty union, we had organizations that were about building connections and power. Right. And the thing is, I think the hardest thing, but one of the things that's so important, I believe, at least, you know, in order to kind of creating that power, it's got to be more than, well, I'll put it in these terms, not Trump. Right. Trump, bad man. Think about that logic. Right. That was what Hillary Clinton ran on and the Democrats ran on in 2016. Trump, bad man. It's got to be more than that. It cannot just be, we're not the other people, right? We have to prove that we're something else. And, you know, I interviewed not too long ago on Out to Coop Live a group of students at Kutztown University, KU activists, and I talked to them a little about that, and they kept on coming back to this. And, I can't remember which one of them said it at first, but it didn't kind of register for me at first. But the second, third time it came, I'm like, oh, I see what they're talking about. Talking about the organizing, like as a whole, as a community. And I basically said about the relationships that are forged in their organizing moment and spending a lot, you know, spending conscious time and effort about that sense of community and solidarity, building it from the ground up. Right? It's not just about like, we're not the students who are currently leading, right? We're better than them and we're going to take those down. No. We're going to do something else. We're going to build power from the ground up. And I think to a certain degree, it happens at any institution. I know it happened in our union, right? In ABSCUF, where it became about kind of wanting to get involved in electoral politics within the union and taking our eye off the capacity building, about the organizing, about the building connections with students, with community members. Right. And some of that is just like, look, some of us got tired. right? And, you know, there are, I think right now there's some new folks that have come in that are really have some of that same thing on energy, and I think that's what it's going to take. Brian just put in the comments, say, if these tenure busting bills pass and start spreading, there'll be a lot more rank and file waking up and getting pissed. I think that's right. Right? I do think that is true. And I think it's going to suck that that's true. Right? I mean, I think, look, we're in a moment in history, right? And I'll start winding us down from here. It's like we're at this kind of moment in history when, you know, it's the go big or go home moment. Right? They're like, what do you got to lose at this point? Everything is in crisis, which means everything is ready to be remade. Everything is in crisis, so everything is being ready, is ready to be remade. That's where we're at. You don't go half measure on a pandemic because people will die. You go big, right? This is why, you know, the crap happening in the national politics, but I won't get in right now, that's, it gets worrisome, right? You don't just give a few people health insurance, you get everybody health insurance. You don't just pay some people kind of a check to kind of survive, you get everybody. All in. Let's do it. Big. Right? Except we got a chancellor of the State Center for Higher Education, and when he says big, what he means is like austerity like you have never seen before. Right, he brings that kind of that ethos of disruption from Silicon Valley, where disruption for itself, the taking apart of these quote unquote old structures and turning them to something else, right? Making a boatload of cash along the way, I don't know, maybe. That by itself is supposed to be good. That's supposed to be the measure of good. Disruption and destruction. We have got the countervailing weight already in front of us. We just need to follow it. We need to follow Black Lives Matter, right? And the demands. We need to follow what's happening with DSA. We need to follow what's happening here in Pennsylvania, PA stands up. We need to be part of that. Following maybe is the wrong word. We need to be part of that and part of that energy. And when we're told things, well, I don't know, some people might be might be upset by that. We've got three choices, but two that I would recommend. One could be just like, F you, we're doing it anyways. Or two, nod politely and do it anyways, right? The third one is to kind of feel all despair and kind of like go back in your hole and say, I guess it can't be done. That's old and dusty and it needs to be put to bed. That's what I think. So anyways, I appreciate everybody sticking with us tonight, sticking with me for so long tonight. I know this is not the usual format for a Monday night one. This has been something that has been, this stuff has plagued me for some time, I have to say, because I spent I literally put aside my academic project, my research and everything to do this, to research this stuff, because I thought it was going to be of value. I thought the kind of energy and time that it takes to dig through and learn how to read these budgets and then try to explain it could be part of that struggle. And for a long time, it felt like I was just being patted on the head and told to go away, right? That I was crazy, right? That I was like, you know, whatever. I was the person that was kind of like being too extreme. And yet time after time after time after again, it's exactly what continues to happen. And I watch people around me fall for the same thing over and over and over again. Hope springs eternal. Damn it, I wish it did not. I mean, because people like hope without action, hope in the air means nothing. Hope disconnected from action and plan and strategy is nothing. It's prayer. So we need that other thing. We need the strategy, the action, the plan. And we can't be relying upon one or two individuals to do it. We have power when we work together. If we rely upon a small group of individuals to accomplish it on their own, those people will eventually burn out and we'll be back to where we start all over again. That cannot happen. Okay, thank you, Brian. Brian put in a link that's not safe for work. Or is it? Just saying. Cool. There's one thing that I want to close out on. Unless anybody else has any things they want to throw in, but one thing I want to close out on is, and I hate to make these kind of predictions, but I'm going to make these kind of predictions. We saw a round of retrenchments in the state system of higher education that targeted primarily IUP, not entirely, but primarily IUP. And IUP is the one that's getting it, you know, full force right now. And that was because those were retrenchments that came about in August, and that was a financial decision, right? So we have these two different things in our contract, programmatic and financial retrenchment. This spring, right? Last spring, remember, the deadline comes up in April, I believe, right? That if the university wants to make a programmatic retrenchment, basically eliminate programs because it wants to, they have to, you know, say, okay, by April, whatever. Last year, before that deadline came, right before that deadline came, the pandemic hit and everything got shut down. Right? I am fully expecting that we are going to see the next round of retrenchments come hard this year. So be prepared, everybody. And I'm going to try to get this stuff together in some way that's going to be much more useful for people. I've got some people working on this too as well. And I'll keep putting this stuff out. But thanks, everybody, for kind of hanging out with me in the weeds tonight, as it were. I really appreciate the time. And I can't tell you how much of a kind of a sanity-producing space this is. Even sometimes when... you know, there are nights when we have lots of people call in. There's other people, like tonight was great. We have some folks kind of put in the comments. We had on Monday too as well. We had some great comments coming in. That's even better because then we can talk about it. But even if it's just about sharing, right, and kind of imagining folks out there, it's extraordinarily helpful on my end too as well. So I appreciate it. And that maybe give you a little window into the world of why we close and open with this song by Jonathan Mann. So. Listen, I appreciate you sticking with me. Thank you for all the work that you're doing. Thank you for your support. Thank you for sharing this out with your friends. I appreciate it. And we'll see you on Friday for our weekly Out the Coop podcast, our flagship with Sean. Next week, Out the Coop Live. See ya!